Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Right, it's my turn. And this week I chose a story called The Demon Lover by Shirley Jackson. What can I do? She thought out on the street again. It was impossible to go home, not with Jamie somewhere between here and there. She stood on the sidewalk so long that a woman, leaning out of a window across the way, turned and called to someone inside to come and see. Finally, on an impulse, she went into the small delicatessen next door to the apartment house, on the side that led to her own apartment. There was a small man reading a newspaper, leaning against the counter. When she came in, he looked up and came down inside the counter to meet her. Over the glass case of cold meats and cheese, she said timidly, "I'm trying to get in touch with a man who lived in the apartment house next door, and I just wondered if you know him." "Why don't you ask the people there?" the man said, his eyes narrow, inspecting her. "It's because I'm not buying anything," she thought. And she said, "I'm sorry, I asked them, but they don't know anything about him. They think he left this morning." "I don't know what you want me to do," he said, moving a little back toward his newspaper. "I'm not here to keep track of guys going in and out next door," she said quickly. "I thought you might have noticed, that's all. He would have been coming past here a little before 10 o'clock. He was rather tall, and he usually wore a blue suit." "Now, how many men in blue suits go past here every day, lady?" the man demanded. "You think I got nothing to do, but I'm sorry," she said. She heard him say, "For God's sake," as she went out the door. As she walked toward the corner, she thought, "He must have come this way. It's the way he'd go to get to my house. It's the only way for him to walk." She tried to think of Jamie. Where would he have crossed the street? What sort of person was he actually? Would he cross in front of his own apartment house at random in the middle of the block at the corner? On the corner was a newsstand. They might have seen him there. She hurried on and waited while a man bought a paper and a woman asked directions. When the newsstand man looked at her, she said, "Can you possibly tell me if a rather tall young man in a blue suit went past here this morning around 10 o'clock?" When the man only looked at her, his eyes wide and his mouth a little open, she thought, "He thinks it's a joke or a trick," and she said urgently, "It's very important. Please believe me. I'm not teasing you." "Look, lady," the man began, and she said eagerly, "He's a writer. He might have bought magazines here." "What you want him for?" the man said. He looked at her, smiling, and she realized that there was another man waiting in back of her, and the news dealer's smile included him. "Never mind," she said, but the news dealer said, "Listen, maybe you did come by here." His smile was knowing, and his eyes shifted over her shoulder to the man in back of her. She was suddenly horribly aware of her overyoung print dress and pulled her coat around her quickly. The news dealer said with vast thoughtfulness, "Now, I don't know for sure, mind you, but there might have been someone like your gentleman friend coming by this morning." "About 10?" "About 10," the news dealer agreed. "Tall fella, blue suit. I wouldn't be at all surprised." "Which way did he go?" she said eagerly. "Uptown?" "Uptown," the news dealer said, nodding. "He went uptown. That's just exactly it. What can I do for you, sir?" She stepped back, holding her coat around her. The man who had been standing behind her looked at her over his shoulder, and then he and the news dealer looked at one another. She wondered for a minute whether or not to tip the news dealer, but when both men began to laugh, she moved hurriedly on across the street. I forget how I found this. I think I was looking up like other horror stories. In the workshop that I'm running now, we have a lot of folks that do genre writing, and a lot of
Oh,
it's been
nice.
horror.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's been cool because you and I talk about it a lot, I feel like, but I also feel like the only stories I've read have been for this podcast. So it's neat to kind of see that folks are trying to do that with fiction because I just feel like it's usually something you see in film for the most part. Because we talk all the time about like horror being like a very like visual sort of genre.
It can be, yeah.
It can be, and it like at least like in theaters, it's like all your senses, you know? Like you're reading something and like a noise sets you off, or you see something in the corner of a shot and you get chills and things and
I mean, in some ways, like there's genres of horror. There's like gross out horror, and there's like psychological horror. There's
yeah.
jump scare kind of stuff, you know?
Right. A lot of it just like lends itself to the visual thing. Point being that I'm impressed that there's people in my workshop that are doing horror and doing it pretty well. And I do think that if you had to like pick a subgenre, it'd be more like the psychological stuff. There are some things that are like grotesque and weird, but because
Yeah.
you're not actually seeing them, like it's all happening in your head. And so what's more effective is like this thriller aspect of like, we talk about like dread a lot when we talk about these, and that's what feels like horror.
Dread works. Menace can work. We talked about Menace for was it Joyce Carol Oates, the Jeffrey Dahmer one?
Yeah, so there's just like a couple ways that you can like accomplish it. And I think in this story, I had to read some interpretations of it to like fully appreciate what critics at least are saying that Shirley Jackson did with it.
Uh-oh.
You know, because it's like a metaphor.
I didn't read any of
Well, the whole
that.
story is about a woman who's supposed to get engaged. She's engaged, but she's supposed to go to like to the courthouse and marry this guy she's only known for a couple weeks, and like,
He never
she's like
shows up, and then
he never shows up
she
and then
goes
she goes
searching.
looking. Yeah. And like you expect her to find him at the end for there to be like some sort of confrontation, maybe.
Except I saw at the front where it said Shirley Jackson, and I was like, it's not going to be that.
Right. Right. But she's literally on a goose chase for a man.
Yeah.
And you expect her to like run into him and find out that he's, I don't know, cheating on her or has like five other lovers. And really, she never finds him.
Yeah.
And some of the criticism is like, the guy never existed. But then it's hard to know that because then there's scenes with the people that rented the flat out to this guy. And they're like, oh God, what did he do? He left this morning. So there's like some tangible stuff. And then there's scenes like the one I read where you can see these men inventing on the spot a narrative for this girl to kind of play with her.
You see, that's even when she got to his supposed flat, they didn't specifically say, oh, yeah, I know him. He lives
No.
there. It was she provides all the information to everybody. He's like, he liked to wear blue. It's
They're
like,
like, yeah,
there's
I
a guy
know
who
him.
was blue. I saw
Yeah.
somebody wearing blue. Maybe it's this guy. And then she like latches onto that, goes to their apartment. It's like, yeah, the guy wore blue. He was tall.
And then she's like, he was a writer, so he probably was getting magazines. And it's like, you don't know that.
Yeah, everyone she talks to, she supplies all the information. Like the section you read, it's like, where did he go after he left this newsstand? Did he go
Uptown?
uptown? And
He's
they're
like,
like,
yep.
yeah, sure, uptown. That sounds great.
Yeah.
So we don't even know if she's even gone to the right apartment in the first place, right?
No, but it feels like this because what for what we know about Shirley Jackson, it's a type of horror. It's a type of like scary story. And at least like there's a sense throughout of just like impending doom and like high anxiety, like just high anxiety throughout. And it reminds me of the other story I think I brought it into. It was written by a woman like about a lady waiting for a phone call from a guy.
Yes, a telephone call.
So it's the same thing where it's like there's a lot of ways to minimize this experience for women that are falling in love with men and it's like unrequited, you know? You can like dismiss these women as like they read too much into it or they're really desperate or whatever it is. They end up coming off crazy. And that's a type of horror. It's almost like the yellow wallpaper where it's just like these
Yes, I
women are
was thinking
being
exactly that.
gaslit. Yeah, left and right, whether by this man in particular or these men on the street. A lot of the criticism I was reading like took a bigger view of this story and said that like, you know, this was of a time and place where women's success was very much tied to their marriage and their, you know, like if they had a man in their life or kids or whatever. And if they didn't, you were just kind of like outcasts. And for this main character, it's like she's thrilled to have finally maybe had this like security in her life. And then it's like getting snatched away and she seems insane. And so it's really easy to like look at this woman and be like, oh my God, the guy didn't exist or the guy never really liked you. Or maybe you made this whole fucking thing up. But to do that is to like dismiss what it must be like for women, especially of that time, where this is not just tied to your reputation, it's tied to your livelihood. You weren't just like named a crazy cat lady. There's plenty of crazy cat ladies today who all make money and are very happy, believe it or not. But back then, it might have meant that you were going to be destitute, you know, like you couldn't work or like people were not going to talk to you anymore. Like the story opens where she's about to write a letter to her sister saying, like, you'll never believe it, but I'm about to go get married. And she like kind of crumples the letter up and it's like she's kind of hedging her bets, right? She's kind of like, oh, this is weird to kind of say, but I really want to share the news with her. This is great news for me. This marriage means I'm successful and I'm seen and I'm worthy and I'm all this kind of stuff. So like, I don't know, maybe I'm picking these stories because I'm like, oh, I get it. But it does feel like horror that way. It's like it's very, very, very high anxiety.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The anxiety of it. I think of this as like a psychological horror,
Yeah.
this story. It's obviously not jump scares. It's not gross out. It's not that kind of horror. It's not when you read The Demon Lover, you're like wondering,
Yeah.
is like some literal satanic figure going to like she's going to go around a corner and it's going to be like this horned creature that she discovers her boyfriend was actually the devil.
Yeah.
But then it turns out to be nothing. But I was thinking she's not tracking him. This is like she has lost track of him the moment he didn't show up because every step
Right.
along the way is the link to what she thought he might be was so tenuous. There's no way that
Right.
at the end she's going to go around a corner and find him.
Right.
It wouldn't make sense. I mean, if it's the devil, yeah, maybe it does make sense. But yeah, so it is mostly psychological. It's about her kind of state of mind for all of this, which is why it plays so well into what the critics you're reading were talking about, because that state of mind that you said, that anxiety, is an effect of all kinds of other things that you can apply this thought process to.
Right.
So it's easy to take what the story seems to be showing us and think about it in terms of other phenomena that create similar feelings.
Right. I only found this out after reading about it because I haven't read all of Shirley Jackson, but apparently, like the name James Harris in the story, it's Jamie Harris.
Jamie, yeah.
Yeah, she uses for a couple other characters, including like in the lottery.
Oh, I missed
Yeah, like
that.
it's James Harris in the lottery, and then the other one is another short story that she wrote called like Mother Used to Make. And so these critics were pointing out that like in each of these instances, this is like a recurring male figure that's demonic somehow. Like he's as
Oh, nice.
like the bad guy. So like maybe, had you been a close reader, you would be looking at this and know that it's all built to something.
Well, so when I started reading this, like the beginning of the story is like her fussing around, trying to figure out what to wear, waiting. It's almost like you said, that telephone call story where she's just waiting and she's just like kind of ramping herself up. But the whole early part of the story is very fussy in its details.
Right.
Like it's like she put the cup here, she put the thing there, she touched this, she moved that, this thing got moved over there, she put on this dress, she stitched it up, she put it, took it off, changed into this one, she had these thoughts. It's
Right.
like everything is happening. It's like it's very minute in its details, which I was describing as fussy in my head.
Yeah.
And that fussy, those fussy details, that like fussy kind of description is reflecting her own fussiness. Like she's being fussy in that moment. It's her mood is
Right.
like got that anxiety already kind of building in it. And because those things are so linked in that early part of the story, I think it sets the scene. It's setting up a psychological story. Like
Right.
we know at some level, because of the way that those things are mirroring each other, and because the details are describing a scene, but the way they're being described is setting up a psychology that we
Okay.
know this is going to be a psychological kind of like journey.
Right.
So everything that happens after that just plays into that exact same thing. Like you already pointed out, the whole building anxiety of it, or developing anxiety.
Yeah.
It takes on the kind of like the form of a mystery where it feels like it's a mystery. We need to learn something. So let's go seek information. And then we're getting bits of information, but you realize that that information isn't, none of it is things she didn't know before. She's supplying it. So it's like building on that same idea of being in her head.
I think too, like compared to the phone call story, one of the ways that this anxiety is really built is the fact that she's on a literal mission.
Oh, yeah.
Like she's moving from place to place. She's not sitting in her house. She is at first.
Yeah.
She sits in her house for a long time where she's kind of thinking to herself, like, what's going to happen? Where is he? She's counting down the hours. He becomes late. She's like fussing with her outfit and all this kind of stuff. But I think that the story really picks up when she leaves her house and then she's going to go out looking for him because it's at the point when she leaves her house that she's kind of convinced herself that maybe he's in trouble or he's run into something. This is like at a time when he couldn't text her. She
Yeah,
couldn't
no
check his
cell phones
location.
though.
Yeah. She's like, wait, but he's posting on Instagram. She has to leave to go find him. So it picks up action-wise, but it also lends a sort of like credibility to this hunt. When the woman in the other story is sitting next to her phone and spiraling, you're like, lady, do your thing. Who knows what this man's doing? Maybe it has nothing to do with you, though. And here it's like she's kind of convinced us that she needs to go. She needs to go leave. Something has happened and she's got to get to the bottom of it, sort of. And then we're kind of along for the ride. We're like, oh shit, she might know something we don't. We don't know yet how crazy she is. We only know that she spent a little bit of time trying to pick out an outfit to marry a dude she hasn't seen in a while, but like, I don't know, maybe she's not crazy.
There are clues along the way, though. The way everyone reacts to her is as if she's crazy.
Yeah.
They're like, what are you talking about? Like, how am I possibly supposed to remember a guy in a blue suit who came in
Right.
here at 10 o'clock?
Yeah.
Like, I
And
don't
like,
watch people who come and go at the next door.
no, but it's not until she leaves her house too that we get that gut check.
Yes.
Because she's just sitting there, like, kind of in her own thoughts, and her own thoughts are that this is real, this is happening, I have to get ready for it. The time is going to be this time, and all this kind of stuff.
I mean, we can notice along the way that everyone's kind of being mean to her and dismissive of her and like just kind of agreeing, like the way you would nod and smile at someone who's crazy just to make them go away. Like, okay, yeah, all right, move
Yeah.
along. But then she kind of like recognizes that as well because she considers approaching a policeman and she's
Right.
like, why don't I go to the police? You go to the police for a
Right.
missing person. And then she thought, what a fool I'd look like. She had a quick
Right.
picture of herself standing in a police station saying, yes, we're going to be married today. So because everyone's been mean, it's getting to her. It's like getting in her head. She understands that she's grasping at straws and she's not really like things aren't quite right. Like this is
Right.
like a really tenuous connection between what she wants and where she's going.
Yeah, like even in the section that I read, like she's paying attention in that moment to like how the men are perceiving her, how they're kind of playing with her.
Yeah, exactly.
She's not unaware of all of this. It's
And
just
she's
kind of
grumpy
like,
about it. She's like, I was gonna give him a tip, but they're laughing at me over here.
yeah, she's like, all right, well, I'm not gonna do that.
And even self-conscious, she covers because she's like, oh, this dress makes me look so young. I'm gonna cover myself. So a lot of that, because she's taking action in the world, like you said, it's like it's more public. It's more public display than like pacing your home, your living room, waiting for a phone call.
Yeah, and it makes it seem like there will be an actual encounter. And instead, we just kind of like forget exactly how it ends.
She finds a rat. There's a rat in an abandoned abandoned room. And then the voices, people inside some other
Yeah,
room,
she hears
they're
like the
talking
other, she
about her.
runs into the rat, and then she hears voices in the other apartment. And then it kind of talks about how she revisits that apartment several times and knocks, and nobody ever comes to the door. But it's like, if she were to think about it for a minute, we know as the reader, this is a random apartment. It has nothing to do with the first apartment. She never knew him to live here. She's just like zeroed in on this being the cause, the reason. I listen to a dating podcast for advice all the time. And this is like one of the things the host says all the time is to women usually that are calling in, you can't get closure from these kinds of things. Like, this would be a character that would want to have a face-to-face confrontation with Jamie Harris and be like, what
Oh, yes.
happened? But the closure is that he's not there. He doesn't want you. The closure is that he's a piece of shit. He didn't tell you that he didn't want to get married, or he flaked on you, or whatever it is. But she's doing what a lot of the callers into the show do, which is giving him a million benefits of the doubt and trying to rationalize what is not rational behavior. And she'd be satisfied in a lot of ways if she found out that he was murdered or died in a car crash or like arrested, you know, somehow out of reach, but not by his own choice. She's like really open to a possibility where he's in trouble still.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that happens. That's not what we're supposed to take away from this one, though. We're supposed to know that like she's spiraling because she wants an answer, but the answer is in his absence.
It's interesting because the way it's set up, as like I said before, as a mystery, kind of makes us want an answer too. It's another way in which we are always in her psychology in this story. And so we're like, oh, where is he? Where is he? Are we gonna find him at the end?
I think the story does a good job that way, probably because it's what Shirley Jackson set out to do of, you know, making this character less crazy than like sympathetic. You know, she might be going through something right now that she's like lost her tether, but it's not because she's crazy. It's because like there's a lot of pressure on her for this to work out. And the fact that it's like slipping away is just like really hard for her to stomach. And when it comes to him specifically, she's like, this isn't it. No, he loves me. Like, he wouldn't do this. We got to figure it out. So, like, while we're reading it, we might slowly realize that she's not with it completely, but we're not making fun of her.
Oh no. But that's how the ending is surprising but inevitable. We get the sense that this isn't going the way she wants it to go. So it's inevitably not going to end with what she wants. But it's surprising in that it goes nowhere. It goes to like this room who might have occupants or might be an echo. We don't know. So when we get to that ending, it forces us to reconsider everything. It's like, okay, why does she wind up here? Let's backtrack. How did this start again? And so you have to rethink the story. It's like one of those kind of endings that makes you want to reread the story.
And it's also like a lot of the criticism I was reading was saying that, you know, by the end, maybe we're supposed to think that he never existed in the first place. So, like, to your point, like, she's feeding all of these people she encounters information about this man, and maybe they're somehow complicit in saying, like, yeah, I think he went that
Yeah,
way.
sure, why not? These ball flowers.
But he might very well exist, and he might just be such a piece of shit that he's successfully disappeared, right? He conned her for a time, he got what he wanted, whatever it was, and now he's on to the next, or he's like a nomad somehow, like had no intention of marrying her. That's one possibility. And then a lot of what I was reading that makes this more of like a psychological thriller is like that she invented this man. She's been unwell from the start. He doesn't exist. Like, she invented an entire backstory and a date and a time and like an event, and none of it was ever gonna happen. And that's like a scarier kind of premise. But it's also the kind of thing where had she penned that letter to her sister and then her sister follows up and she has to explain what happened, that might be the sister's conclusion, because the sister is happy and married and well somewhere else, and she's never heard of this man until the sister told her about him. And she might have all of the valid questions of, well, what did he really say, you know, or like, have you tried calling him or whatever. There might be one other person in her life that could like poke holes in this, but as it is, she is on an island. She has no one gut checking her until she goes out into the public and none of these people care about her, so we don't know.
Her sister's like, this James Harris shows up in a lot of different places. He was in this
She's like, I've
lottery
heard.
town. He was.
She's like, James Harris, I know him. So it's like, that's the other kind of possibility. But I'm happy with either. I'm happy with it very much being like, he was a real guy. They did talk for like a month, and maybe in that time they saw each other three times, but she's like, this is how it happens, and thank God it's happening. Like, I don't care. Either way, it's working.
Yeah. I mean, whatever the seed was that started the, and partly it doesn't matter to the story. I think that kind of ambiguity, it like lets the critics make leaps.
Well, and like I said, like the fact that it's the same name, Jamie Harris, James Harris. I mean, those are like clues, not just for critics, but for readers, you know, that she's leaving. Like, this is a bad guy somehow. But my other thought was, if I didn't know what little I know about Shirley Jackson and the genre she commonly writes, like, I might not have read this as an actual like thriller. thriller. I might not be viewing it through that lens so much as like more the societal take on it, the metaphor
Oh,
take.
yeah.
You know, I
Yes.
might have read this as like a woman that was being gaslit by everyone and everything around her, and that it wasn't scary, but it was like shitty.
I really was looking forward to Shirley Jackson is the name, and I haven't read a lot of her, but I know she does some horror stuff, but I don't know what kind of horror stuff. So in my head, I see, oh, the demon lover. So she's gonna find this like horned devil when she opens a door at some point. That's gonna be exciting. I'm looking forward to that. But that was, I was like, oh, of course, a psychological horror. Okay, that's different.
Right. Yeah, and that could have also been pulled off, you know? I'm trying to think of like what my kind of takeaway is because it's very much centering around everything we're talking about right now with like what accomplishes like good horror. I don't know. I think that, you know, you could rewrite this story modern day where a girl thinks she met a guy or thinks that she had like a relationship with someone on a dating app and, you know, they never actually meet, but they're dating, right? They're dating. And then like he unmatches her and she doesn't understand what happened, but he must be in the hospital. There's versions of this, believe it or not, like
Yes.
in Facebook groups. Where like women talk about dating experiences specific to certain cities. They're absolutely unhinged Facebook groups. Some of them are like catching cheaters. Some of them are like, I'm talking to this guy. Is he safe? And people will be like, no, he beats everyone. I could see this being rewritten today, and maybe it would be less scary because we're familiar with today's like landscape, you know, where we could easily like attribute the premise as like something that this woman made up in her head, you know? But then I would be reading it for its like commentary on society. For its commentary on why women feel this way or act this way or whatever.
This is my feelings on Instagram, not necessarily on, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like the same way we talk about how certain sci-fi stories are just like a packaging or a vehicle for another story, which is human interaction, whatever it is. Horror is the same thing. And so I guess my takeaway is that, like, even if we didn't know that Shirley Jackson was trying to write this, or even if that wasn't the interpretation of the story at the time, it's still like an enjoyable read in the sense that we can understand. Now, maybe it's only through this kind of metaphor, through this kind of like physical hunt for this man, that we can appreciate what it's like in this woman's head. So you can write horror stories by getting us in a character's head that way. And it might be like a spun up metaphor where you have an actual like monster somewhere. But if the effect is that by the end you realize like what it must be like for this girl that has to go home now and be a spinster, has to like admit defeat. She's so hung up on this dude, that might have been her last chance for whatever, and now maybe she's screwed. That's scary. But maybe she's only sympathetic if we make it this big plot heavy thing.
I want to tie that to my takeaway because we talk about a lot of times how fiction is like written fiction is one of the few places you can get inside someone's head, like truly see the inner workings of another person's head, like the way you can't do
Right.
on film and you can't do in other media. And this story, what the thing, my takeaway was what I mentioned earlier about how the fussiness of detail at the beginning reflected the fussiness of mood, and it kind of portended this like psychological unraveling that was going to happen. And I don't mean unraveling like she was unraveling. I just meant the story was going to unravel a psychological perspective. So my takeaway was about how that works. Like we talked about how in some episode long ago, I mentioned that, you know, it's not merely the point of view isn't merely the point from which things are viewed. It's also what's being viewed. And here, a lot of the details, it's like it's the presentation of so many details in such a fussy way that you like really, it's what she's looking, she's concentrating on this, she's looking at this, she's looking at this, and it's like moving from thing to thing. But it's also hyper focused on each thing as it's moving. There's no description of like she was hyper focused on everything she looked at. Her mind was like flitting from thing to thing. It's just detail, 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 detail. So you feel it as she's moving through that room and like what she's focusing on.
Yeah, it's kind of like the phone story.
Yeah, kind of like the phone story, but told in a different way. And I was kind of thinking about it in terms of like, is this a feature of the prose or is this a feature of the choice of which details to show us? And it's a little of both, but I think it's mostly in the details. It's mostly in what we're looking at, and maybe a little of how we're looking at it. You know, she hung the two dresses side by side on the outside of the closet door and opened the glass doors carefully closed upon the small closet that was her kitchenette. She turned on the burner under the coffee pot and went to the window. It was sunny. When the coffee pot began to crackle, she came back and poured herself coffee into a clean cup. I'll have a headache if I don't get some solid food soon, she thought. All this coffee, smoking too much, no real breakfast. A headache on her wedding day. She went and got the tin box of aspirin from the bathroom closet and slipped it into her blue pocketbook. She'd have to change to a brown pocketbook if she wore the print dress. It's not merely objects, but it's like what her thought process is as she's moving. But it's each individual thing, and it moves very quickly between them.
Yeah, and there's something really cool about seeing her at this stage where we don't know that yet that this guy doesn't exist. And so all of these thoughts that she's having could very well just be like...
Is it anxiety because she's about to get married, right?
Yeah,
like everything's got to be right.
Yeah, she's kind of like, oh, okay, I gotta make coffee. I'm up in time for this. I got to decide on my dress. I should have decided about this sooner if I switched to this. Yeah. So when I first read it, I was like, this is normal. And then it kind of lends itself to what unfolds after it, which is that now that we're primed for her thought process, all of the other details that she sees are sort of informing this other narrative that she doesn't have a firm grasp on this like we thought she did.
I would say that the story isn't inherent in the way this is presented. Like, her fussy mood is in this. It's a fussy description for a fussy mood, but the story that unfolds after that mood isn't determined by that fussiness. Because once we learn the cause of it is her kind of confusion about things, that's later. And that has nothing to do with the actual feeling in the moment.
Right.
So you could write this exact same opening and then have the story go somewhere completely different.
Yeah.
Like, it could be a Jane Austen thing where she just goes to a wedding.
Yeah. Her own wedding, and it's a happy day. And
yeah.
And then she finds out that her husband's like got a gambling problem or something.
But anyway, using perspective in that way through the details we're focusing on and how we're focusing on them and where we're moving within that focus to express an emotion through your prose, that's my takeaway.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/Naples Writers Workshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.